Welcome to A Rounded About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller. So there's a preacher at a revival service, and at the end of the service, he tells anybody who has, you know, special requests or special needs to come forward.
Bubba walks down the aisle. The preacher says, "What do you want me to pray for, Bubba?" Bubba says, "I need you to pray for my hearing." The preacher cups his hands over Bubba's ears, prays for God's intercession. It goes on for 2 or 3 minutes.
This is Andrew Hudgens, by the way. He's an author, and he's written a book about jokes. This is from a promotional video for the book. Anyway, back to Bubba and the preacher.
Then he pulls his hands off Bubba's ears, claps them in front of Bubba's face, and says, "How is your hearing now?" Bubba says, "Oh, I don't know yet, preacher. That hearing's not till next Wednesday in the federal courthouse in Montgomery."
Andrew Hudgens loves to tell jokes. In fact, his memoir is called The Joker. He loves corny ones, crude ones, lewd ones. He has an almost compulsive need to tell them. In his memoir, he writes about telling an off-color O.J. Simpson joke that kind of killed his chances of making friends with somebody he really respected. Or another time, at a poetry reading, he did something absurd with a glass of water that seemed to offend about half the audience. Coming up in the show, we'll hear about that. We'll also talk about the celebration of Southern literature. Hudgens grew up in Alabama and North Carolina, and he's a member of the Fellowship of Southern Writers. He'll be here in Chattanooga for the celebration, which takes place April 16th through the 18th in Chattanooga. We're also going to talk about poetry, although Hudgens' memoir has been getting him attention the last few years from NPR and the New York Times, among other places. He's best known as a poet, and he's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and been a National Book Award finalist for his poetry. Stay tuned. We'll be back with Andrew Hudgens in a moment.
Do you own a business, or do you have an idea for a business, or maybe you're an investor looking to invest in a new business? Well, there's a show that you've got to listen to. I'm Monty Brule, and every Friday morning at 10 a.m. and again at 8 p.m., I'll be hosting Start It Up. Come on, get aboard the entrepreneurial train. Chattanooga has a lot going on. And remember, if you're gonna be a bear, be a grizzly. Come on.
Andrew Hudgens, thank you for speaking with me today.
My pleasure.
Some people tell jokes that help them socially. Some people use humor to help everyone relax in an uncomfortable situation. They can use humor to, you know, diffuse tension. Other people have a sense of humor that can kind of work against them. They tell jokes that might offend or alienate people at social gatherings. And in your memoir, The Joker, you talk about having a need to tell jokes that triumphs your sense of propriety and good sense. Why do you have this need to tell jokes that sometimes offend people, even people you really respect?
You know, I wondered about that all my life. It's just the sheer pleasure of the laughter. And if the situation is tense, sometimes the laughter is, usually the laughter is more explosive. It's more fun.
In the book, you talk about this one particular situation. It wasn't a joke. It was more physical humor. But it was at a poetry reading, and you were one of the people reading, and this involved a glass of water. Could you tell us that story?
Yes, it's an old joke, actually. But at the writers' conference, a couple of the senior figures, this was 20 years ago, had commented on Randall Jarrell saying that for any writer to stop and take a sip of water during a reading, particularly a poetry reading, was pretentious. And this always kind of seems silly to me because your throat dries out when you're doing things like that. But anyway, so what I had done was I held the glass of water up, and I acknowledged that both of these senior writers had cited Randall Jarrell and said, well, that's because they were using the wrong side of the glass. And then I put the top side of the glass in my mouth, the bottom side then funneled the water right down my my shirt. In other words, I threw water all over myself. And what was interesting was some people laughed, some people were shocked, and it offended the two senior poets, which I hadn't intended to do, but as soon as it happened, I realized that that was built into the act, that it had to be seen as the insult that I didn't intend it to be.
Did you ever have a chance to, you know, go back to them and explain, I wasn't trying to make fun of you, I was just doing this thing to be funny?
Oh, they were so mad at me that it wasn't really, I don't think I could have convinced them otherwise. But yeah, I did apologize to other people about it and indicated that I wished I hadn't done it.
Well, it seems like at many poetry readings, the poet who is the funniest, whoever he or she is often the audience favorite.
Yeah, that's true, and that's both a good and a bad thing. I mean, it means you're paying attention to the audience, but it also means that you can clown away the seriousness of the work, too, and I think I've been guilty of that.
Why is it pretentious to drink water? I mean, yeah, I'm on the radio, for example. We have to drink water all the time because your throat does dry out.
I think the idea was in Jarrell's comment. I mean, we're talking about a guy who wrote this 50, 60 years ago. I think he saw it as the pause for approbation that you would be taking in a situation like that.
In your memoir, The Joker, you talk about this need to tell jokes that sometimes offends people, and you trace it back to your childhood, growing up in a military family and moving around a lot. What did your father do in the military?
He was a West Point grad who had opted at that time to go into the Air Force, which was then an option because they were just merging out of the Army Air Force. And my parents had had a child, a daughter who was born before I was and then died before I was born in a car accident. Our family wasn't a place of great laughter and happiness. And so I remember being attracted to, you know, my uncles would laugh, and that seemed very strange to me. And then I discovered, you know, humor at school in books, really, more than with my fellow schoolmates. But it just seemed like a happy thing, and not the kind of depression that hung over our house.
And it seems like in the book you're talking about how your father had very little sense of humor at all. Your mother, even though she was very much affected by this death that happened before you were born, she still had more of a sense of humor and laughed at your jokes.
Yeah, that's true. And she told me some jokes herself, ones that she got from her brother, and those were racist jokes. And she was, I think, dubious of them, but yet at another level still thought they were funny. And I think she... It was really strange because I assumed when she told me these jokes, we were making fun of the racists in the jokes. And I didn't understand as a kid that that wasn't really what the jokes were doing.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting because today you have shows, I think, like Family Guy, for example, where the main character, Peter, is just a buffoon and often does things that are very sexist or sometimes racist, but it's not supposed to be making fun of women or minorities. It's making fun of him, this buffoon who thinks this way.
Exactly. That's been a pretty strong change over the last, you know, half century.
In the book, you say that jokes helped you learn about religion, race, and sex. How did jokes help you think about religion and learn about religion specifically?
Well, I grew up in the Baptist church, and we would make jokes about people who didn't have full immersion baptism, that kind of thing. And so I would become aware that my Methodist uncles, I had two uncles that were Methodist ministers, had a very different way of thinking about baptism and about religion, and things like that. Things like that. Also jokes, you know, that made fun of our religion, too. I remember the one about why don't Baptists have sex standing up? And the answer, of course, is They're afraid someone will think they're dancing.
I haven't heard that one.
You haven't heard that one?
No, and I've lived in the South my whole life.
Yeah, I heard that one in high school. And somebody told me he just heard it on a stage play in New York, and he laughed because he knew that what the punchline was coming, but that the New York audience didn't know it.
In the book, you talk about elephant jokes, and a lot of the humor in the book is the kind of thing that we couldn't put on the radio, but the elephant jokes, which were really popular when you were a kid, some of those are kind of safe. What were some of your favorite elephant jokes?
They were, like, fascinatingly stupid. You know, how does an elephant hide in a cherry tree? He paints his toenails red. No, just dumb. And it's when somebody asks those questions, you're never going to guess them.
Because the answers are so random, yeah.
Yeah, the answers are random. And that it's a really a kind of a form of surrealism.
Living in Alabama, you heard a lot of racist jokes, and you were saying your mother told some of them as well. And what I think is interesting is in the book, you do include them. You don't just say, well, I heard a lot of jokes, and they're not the kind of things I'd like to repeat. You actually include them. Why did you decide to do that? Because that's something that could make some readers very uncomfortable.
Yeah, I included those on purpose because I think people want not to know that ever happened. That was part of growing up in the South at that time. And I don't put those jokes in there to appreciate them, but to say also, this is what I confronted growing up. This is what I had to think my way through. Both of those things.
Because you were in a situation where as a kid, you know, other kids would just say these jokes, and adults too would just tell you these jokes and assume that because you were white and they were white, you would find them funny.
Exactly.
Your grandmother and your uncle, you talk about, were fairly openly racist, whereas your father was very anti-racist. Why was your father so much the opposite of what you might expect from a person like him?
Two reasons. One was the United States Air Force. When Truman integrated the forces, my dad took that as an order, but also his faith was such that he really believed in the absolute equality of people. And so it was both the military and his Baptist beliefs that that led him that way. Now, my uncle and my grandmother were Baptist too. Their faith did not, that didn't affect their racism.
And growing up, you were reading things like the autobiography of Malcolm X. You know, what was it that attracted you to that, being a white kid in the South, that you were reading something like that?
I think I was trying to understand this different world. You know, that one and James Baldwin and Black Like Me, and then another one that skipped my brain right now, any number of black autobiographies. It was a different world, and yet it was a world that I could see pieces of around me, and I was cut off from it. I was curious. I wanted to know about that.
You talk about in the book your sense of humor and how it relates to your relationships with women and with your first wife and your current wife. How important to you is a sense of humor in a relationship? I mean, I would just say for me and my wife, the sense of humor is probably the only thing that keeps us together sometimes when we're really getting on each other's nerves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. If you can't have that teasing and play, where's the delight in another person? My wife knows that when I try to make her laugh, I am paying attention to her. You can't make people laugh if you don't know what amuses them, and you can't know that unless you're paying pretty close attention to them. And also, you know, when you're going too far and when you're not going too far. And, you know, and her sense of humor is a continuing delight and revelation to me. It's a way of appreciating her too.
You talk about realizing at some point that you're going a little bit too far, particularly when you were a kid and you're doing things that other people don't find funny. What made you realize that? What made you realize, you know, jokes are good, but sometimes it's not the right place and not the right time?
Well, when everybody's mad at you, that's not a good place to be. I think the thing I talk about in the book was being in elementary school and just, you know, like throwing the textbook across the room because I thought that was funny. And the first time I did it, everybody laughed. So I did it again, and then I did it again, and it rapidly becomes not funny. But as you're a kid, you get once, you think you're going to keep getting a laugh for doing it.
Today, you still sometimes make jokes, and then you kind of regret it or just wonder, how did that affect people? Why do you do that? Is it just like a compulsive need? It seems almost like an addiction sometimes.
Yeah, it is. I think it is. It's a kind of a compulsion. And some people enjoy it and some people don't. I have learned a little bit to bite my tongue. But boy, when that joke seems to fit perfectly in the situation, really hard not to keep to bite your tongue and not say it.
Like the universe is just tempting you.
Exactly. Yeah. Come on. Do you have guts or not?
That's Andrew Hudgens. His memoir is called The Joker. The New York Times called it raw and risky. We'll have more after this break.
Funding comes from Scotchy Wealth Management Group, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., helping investors create roadmaps for financial growth. Scotchy Wealth Management, 424-3301.
If you're looking to grow your business or professional practice, consider underwriting on WUTC. It reaches potential new clients inexpensively in an uncluttered environment. Call Ken Dryden at 423-425-4364 for more information.
You're listening to A Roundabout Chattanooga. I'm speaking with Andrew Hudgens. In addition to his memoir, he's written a book of essays and several books of poetry, including one called Shut Up, You're Fine, Poems for Very, Very Bad Children. As a poet, he's been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and he's been a National Book Award finalist. His newest poetry collection is A Clown at Midnight. It came out in 2013, the same year as his memoir. In the second half of the show, we're talking about poetry and the upcoming celebration of Southern literature. At what point did you become aware of contemporary poetry? Because I remember, like, when I was in middle school and high school, I honestly thought nobody wrote poetry anymore because the only poets we studied were people who'd been dead for many years. So I thought it was just something people didn't do anymore. I didn't realize people still wrote and published it these days.
Yeah, the exciting moments for me were, I guess it would have been 10th grade in Montgomery when I discovered two poems in the back of the book that we did not get to. One was T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men, and the other one was Robert Frost's Out, Out, the one in which the boy cuts his hand off and dies. And I was just blown away by this stuff. And when I say contemporary, I would have seen them in 1966, and they were written around 1912. So how contemporary was that? More contemporary than we got to in the book.
Yeah. Your latest book of poetry, A Clown at Midnight, what does that title refer to?
It's a quote by the great horror actor, Leo Chaney? Lon Chaney, that's what I was trying to remember, where he said, the most terrifying thing is a clown at midnight. And what he means, of course, is the unexpected. And if you think about it, it's really kind of true. We go to the circus, we see a clown, we expect the clown in the circus. But if you see a clown walking along the road at midnight, that's something sinister.
Oh, yeah. Many, many horror movies kind of use that trope, yeah. And one of the poems in it, I think that really stands out, is called I Saw My Shadow Walking. Could you read that one?
Sure. I saw my shadow walking. I saw my shadow walking south on Market Street at dawn. He had a long gun in his hand, a Winchester 1901. He held it in the air and waved. I wondered if I died. He walked down to the children's park and sat down on the slide. I hadn't seen him for 2 weeks. He'd slipped his medication and stolen from beneath my bed my Winchester 1901. The cops told him to drop the gun. He squinted at the sun as he swung up and aimed at them, that Winchester 1901. Grace Pittman opened her front door and bent to fetch the news when she heard two pistol shots resound, as she said in interviews. I looked and saw the shadow drop like a punctured bag of air. Grace Pittman told reporters, who didn't really care. My shadow wasn't dangerous. The point, I guess, is moot. He must have hated me so much, he forced the cops to shoot. I scrubbed his blood off slide and swings and shadowless in sun. I walked to City Hall and claimed my Winchester 1901.
Thank you for reading that.
Thank you for asking.
The poem itself, I think it's interesting. It seems to very much have the structure of a joke. It starts out with, as many jokes do, a situation that just makes you go, what? You know, the classic, a duck walks into a bar, a shadow walks down a street carrying a gun, and then the tension builds until there's this sudden, unexpected twist, much like a joke. Was that something you were trying to do consciously, that structure?
Yes. And also it has a touch of sing-songy quality to it, like nursery rhymes, and so I'm trying to get that kind of spooky quality, that kind of slightly inappropriate sinister quality in the poem.
It makes me think of, you know, something that's been in the news quite a bit lately, which is, of course, police shooting people, sometimes people who are unarmed, and people saying police are overreaching. Was that something on your mind as you were coming up with this?
Not in that case. That was a poem I wrote, I don't know, 10 years ago or so.
Oh, wow, 10 years ago. Yeah. So that would have been before Ferguson and Michael Brown and all that.
Way before. Yeah, what I was actually thinking more in this case was suicide by cop.
Your book, The Joker, The Memoir, and A Clown at Midnight both deal very much with humor and jokes. Was that another conscious decision of yours? You said, you know, I'm going to put out a memoir about joking. I should put out a poetry book that kind of has comedy and tragedy at the central theme of it as well.
No, but I was working on both books at the same time. So the thought processes that were in one, they slid back and forth between the two. And so I ended up writing a lot of jokes, I mean, a lot of poems that were jokes or were meditations on humor. Because humor is, as you know, at least a two-sided, probably a many-sided thing. You talked about it draws people together, but one of the ways you draw people together is by excluding other people. So there is that negative side to humor. If you and I are joking and somebody doesn't get the joke, then you and I are actually forming a stronger bond at the cost of that third person. So humor, it has its costs as well as its benefits.
You'll be here for the celebration of Southern Literature, April 16th through 18th. How many times, how often do you come to this?
Well, it's every 2 years, and I think I've been coming at least 10 years, and it's always a ton of fun. We get to hang out with each other, but we also get to meet people in town who come, and most of us go out and talk to high school classes throughout the several counties around Chattanooga. And so we're doing a lot of things around and about town. I'm going to be doing a program, as I've done in the past, at the library. So we do a lot of things to reach out to folks in town.
Well, what is it like meeting high schoolers? Because I really wish when I was, in middle school or high school, I had met somebody who was a contemporary poet and could have said, well, it's not all Shakespeare. There are people alive today still writing poetry.
Still doing yeah. this. I went to a technical school out in Saudi Daisy 2 years ago, and it was very sweet talking to those students. They were engaged, interested. Now, I'm going to give a lot of credit to their teacher because kids don't automatically get interested. The teacher has to set it up, and it's a lot of work for the teacher to do that. So, but she had done a wonderful job, and the kids were really engaged, smart, and the word I keep coming back to is sweet. And that's been the experience of just about everybody I've talked to when they've gone out into classes.
Andrew Hudgens, thank you so much for speaking with us. Is there anything else you want to say?
No, except I've enjoyed talking to you, and I'm looking forward to, again, talking to folks in Chattanooga next week.
Thank you very much. That was Andrew Hudgens. His two most recent books are A Clown at Midnight and The Joker. The celebration of Southern Literature takes place April 16th through the 18th in Chattanooga. You can find the full schedule online at southernlitalliance.org. And before we go, let's hear one more joke.
A man sitting at home reading the newspaper when he hears tap, tap. Looks around. He can't figure out where it's coming from. So he decides to ignore it. Keep reading the paper. Tap, tap, tap. So he gets up and he checks the front door. There's nobody there, but when he looks down, he sees a snail on his front porch. He reaches down, grabs a snail, throws it out into the woods, and goes back reading his paper. 3 years later, he's sitting at that same chair reading the paper, and he hears tap, tap, tap. Again, he's not sure where it comes from. He ignores it. Tap, tap, tap. So he goes to the front door, and he looks. And he looks down, and there's a snail there. And the snail says, "What the hell was that about?"
That's it for Around and About Chattanooga. I'm Michael Edward Miller. Thank you all for listening.